This is a reading of an outline of Esoteric Science by Rudolf Steiner. I'm on chapter 5. This is the second part. I'm on paragraph 18. To begin with, the souls of spiritual students are weak with regard to everything that is perceptible in the world of soul and spirit. During meditation, they will have to expend a great deal of inner energy to hold on to the symbols or mental images that they have built up out of the sense world's stimuli. But if they also want to achieve real observation in a higher world, they must be able to do more than merely hold on to these visualizations. Having done this, they must also be able to spend a certain amount of time in a state that not only permits no stimuli from the outer world of the senses to affect the soul, but also eliminates the earlier visualizations from consciousness. Only after this has been done can what has taken shape through meditation appear in consciousness. The point is that from now on the soul must have enough inner strength so that what has taken shape in this way is really perceived spiritually and does not escape attention, which is all too possible when the soul's inner energy is still only weakly developed. The organism of soul and spirit, which begins to develop, and which the student is meant to grasp in self-perception, is delicate and fleeting. The disturbances from the sense-perceptible outer world and from its after-effects in memory are great, no matter how hard we try to keep them at bay. It is not just a question of the disturbances we notice, but even more of those we are completely unaware of in ordinary life. Let me read that last sentence again. It is not just a question of the disturbances we notice, but even more of those we are completely unaware of in ordinary life. However, in this context, the very nature of the human being makes this transitional state possible. It is possible for the soul to accomplish in the sleeping state what is initially impossible for it in the waking state because of disturbances from the physical world. If we devote ourselves to inner contemplation and are then properly attentive to what happens during sleep, we will notice that we are not, quote-unquote, fast asleep, that our souls have times when they are still active in a certain way, in spite of being asleep. During these states, natural processes keep the influences of the outer world at bay, even though the waking soul is not yet strong enough to ward them off under its own power. But if the meditation exercises have already taken effect, the soul frees itself from unconsciousness during sleep and senses the world of spirit and soul. This can happen in two different ways. Either we are able to realize during sleep that we are now in another world, or we are able, on waking, to recall having been there. The first instance requires greater inner energy than the second, which is, therefore, more prevalent among beginners in spiritual training. Students can gradually get to the point where they realize, after they wake up, that the whole time they were sleeping was spent in another world, and that they emerged from this world when they woke up. Their memories of the beings and realities of this other world will become ever more definite. In one sense or another, what can be called, quote, continuity of consciousness, unquote, that is, the continuation of consciousness during sleep, has set in. This does not mean, however, that these people are always conscious during sleep. It is already a big step toward continuity of consciousness if people who otherwise sleep just like anyone else have certain times when sleep, during sleep, when they can look as though consciously into a world of spirit and soul, or if they can look back in memory on these brief conscious states when they are awake. We must not forget, however, that what is described here is only meant to be a transitional state. If our purpose is to train ourselves, it's good to go through this transitional state, but we should not believe that we should derive a conclusive view of the world of spirit and soul from it. In this state, the soul is uncertain and not yet able to trust its perceptions. Through such experiences, however, it gathers more and more strength in order eventually to be able to keep the disturbing influences of the physical outer and inner worlds at bay when it is awake, and thus to observe the world of soul, spirit and soul without being distracted by any impressions coming from the senses, by the intellect that is bound to the physical brain, or even by the mental images of meditation, which are merely a preparation for spiritual sight, and have now been removed from consciousness. Anything spiritual science makes public in any form should never originate in any other kind of soul-spirit observation than the one that occurs in the fully waking state. Two soul experiences are important as our spiritual training continues. One is what makes us able to say, quote, from now on, when I disregard all the impressions the physical outer world can give me and look into my inner self, I will not be looking at a being whose activity is totally extinguished, but at a being who is aware of itself in a world I knew nothing about as long as I allowed myself to be stimulated only by impressions from my senses and from my ordinary intellect, unquote. At this moment, the soul has the feeling of having given birth to a new being within itself, to the essential core of its own being, as described above. This new being has characteristics that are totally different from those previously present in the soul. The other experience is that of having the old being standing like a second being alongside the new. What we formerly experienced as containing us now turns into something we confront from outside in a certain respect. At times we experience ourselves outside of what we each otherwise regarded as our own essential being, as the individual I. It is as if we were now fully conscious of living in two eyes. One of them we have known all along, the other stands above it like a newborn being. We feel how the first acquires a certain independence with regard to the second, somewhat similar to how the human body has a certain independence with regard to the first I. This experience is very significant because it makes us realize what it means to live in the world we are trying to reach through our training. The second, newborn I can now be guided into perception in the spiritual world. Within it, something can develop that has the same significance for this spiritual world as the sense organs have for the physical world of the senses. Once this development has advanced to the necessary level, we will not only sense ourselves as newborn eyes, but will begin to perceive spiritual realities and spiritual beings in the surroundings, just as we perceive the physical world through our physical senses. This is a third important experience. To really cope at this level of spiritual training, we must count on the fact that self-love and egotism will accompany the strengthening of our soul forces, appearing to a degree that we never experience in our ordinary soul life. It would be a mistake to believe that mere ordinary self-love is what we are talking about at this point. At this level of development, this powerful egotism is intensified to the point where it seems like a force of nature within our own souls, and a rigorous will training is required in order to overcome it. This egotism is not produced by spiritual training. It is always present, but becomes conscious only when we experience the Spirit. It is absolutely necessary for will training to go hand in hand with our other spiritual training. We have a strong urge to feel blissfully happy in the world we have just created for ourselves. As described above, we must be able to extinguish, so to speak, what we have just worked so hard to bring about. Having reached the imaginative world, we must extinguish ourselves. But egotism's strongest urges agitate against this. It is easy to believe that the exercises of spiritual training are something external and disregard the soul's moral development. In response, it must be said that the moral strength that is needed to overcome egotism, as has been described, cannot be acquired without elevating the soul's moral state to the corresponding level. Progress in spiritual training is unthinkable unless it is accompanied by moral progress. Without moral strength, it would be impossible to defeat egotism. All talk of genuine spiritual training, let me read that again, all talk of genuine spiritual trainings not being a moral training at the same time is inaccurate. Only those who have not experienced this personally can doubt our ability to know that we are dealing with realities in what we believe to be spiritual perceptions and not with mere self-deceptions, parenthesis, visions, hallucinations, and the like, parenthesis. The real fact of the matter, however, is that if we have reached this level through a genuine training, we will be able to distinguish mental images of our own creation from spiritual realities, in the same way that any individuals of sound common sense can distinguish their own mental images of a hot piece of iron from the actual existence of a piece they are touching. Healthy experience and nothing else reveals the difference. Even in the spiritual world, life itself is the touchstone. Just as we know in the sense-perceptible world that an imagined piece of iron will not burn our fingers, no matter how hot we imagine it to be, trained students of the spirit know whether they are experiencing a spiritual fact only in their imagination, or whether real facts or beings are making an impression on their awakened spiritual organs of perception. The general rules we have to observe during spiritual training so as not to fall victim to deceptions in this regard will be described later on. At this point, it is extremely important for students of the spirit to have acquired a very specific state of soul when they first became conscious of the newborn I, since it is through the I that we become able to guide our sensations, mental images and feelings, our urges, desires and passions. Perceptions and mental images cannot be left to their own devices in the soul. They must be controlled through thoughtful deliberation. The I is what implements the laws of thinking and uses them to bring order into our life of thoughts and mental images. Something similar is true of our desires, urges, inclinations, and passions. Our ethical principles become the guides for these soul forces. Through moral judgment, the I becomes the soul's guide in this area. If an individual then extracts a higher I from the ordinary one, the original I becomes independent in a certain respect, and it loses as much vital strength as is given to the higher I. Let's suppose, however, that an individual who has not yet developed sufficient ability and stability with regard to laws of thinking and powers of judgment, chooses to give birth to the higher I on this level. This person will only be able to leave behind as much thinking ability for his or her lower I as was developed previously. If the amount of orderly thinking is insufficient, a disorderly, confused, fantastical type of thinking and judging will appear in this person's newly independent, ordinary I. Because the newborn I in such a person can also only be weak, the confused lower I will dominate supersensible perception, and the person in question will not demonstrate balance in judging his or her observations of the supersensible. If this person had developed the faculty of logical thinking sufficiently, it would have been quite safe to allow the lower I to be independent. This is also true in the domain of ethics. If we have not achieved firmness in our moral judgments, if we have not sufficiently mastered our inclinations, urges, and passions, we will allow the ordinary I to become independent under circumstances in which these soul forces are still active. As a result, we may not apply the same high standards of truthfulness to our experiences of supersensible cognition as we do to what we raise to the level of consciousness in the outer physical world. With this slackened sense of truth, we could take all kinds of fantastic imaginings for spiritual reality. firmness in ethical judgments, steadiness of character, and thoroughness of conscience must work into our sense for truth, having first been developed in the eye that is left behind before the higher eye becomes active for purposes of supersensible cognition. This is not meant to scare people away from spiritual training, but it does have to be taken very seriously. If we have the strength of will to do everything necessary to make the first eye inwardly secure in carrying out its functions, we have no reason to be afraid of freeing the second eye through spiritual training to pursue supersensible cognition. However, we must be aware of how powerful self-deception is when it comes to feeling mature enough to undertake something. Students in the spiritual training that is described here develop their thought life to the extent that they will never be in danger of going astray, although this is often assumed to be inevitable. This thought development makes all the necessary inner experiences appear and be played out in the soul as they should be, without being accompanied by harmful aberrations of fantasy. Without appropriate thought development, these experiences can cause profound uncertainty in the soul. Through the method emphasized here, these experiences appear in such a way that it is possible to become completely familiar with them, just as we become familiar with perceptions of the physical world if we are in a sound state of mind. By developing our thought life, we become more able to observe what we are experiencing in ourselves. If we do not develop it, we will not be able to face this experience in a calm and collected manner. An appropriate training lists certain qualities that those who want to find the way into the higher world should acquire through practice. These are, above all, the soul's mastery over its train of thought, its will, and its feelings. The method for bringing this mastery about through practice has two goals. On the one hand, this practice is meant to imbue the soul with stability, certainty, and equilibrium, to the extent that it retains these qualities even when a second eye is born out of it. On the other hand, it is meant to give this second eye strength and support for its journey. Objectivity is what our thinking needs most of all for spiritual training. In the physical world of the senses, life is the great teacher of the human eye as far as objectivity is concerned. If the soul chose to allow its thoughts to wander aimlessly, it would have to be immediately corrected by life so as not to come into conflict with it. The soul's thinking must correspond to the actual course of life's realities. When we turn our attention away from the physical world of the senses, we are no longer subject to its automatic correction, so our thinking will go astray if it is not able to self-correct. This is why students of the Spirit must train their thinking so that it can set its own direction and goals. Their thinking must teach itself inner stability and the ability to stick strictly to one subject. For this reason, the appropriate, quote, thought exercises, unquote, we undertake should not deal with unfamiliar and complicated objects, but with ones that are simple and familiar. Over a matter of months, if we can overcome ourselves to the point of being able to focus our thoughts for at least 5 minutes a day on some ordinary object, parenthesis, for example, a pin, a pencil, or the like, parenthesis, and if during this time we exclude all thoughts unrelated to this object, we will have made a big step in the right direction. Parenthesis, we can consider a new object each day or stay with the same one for several days, parenthesis. Even those who consider themselves thinkers because of their scientific education should not scorn this means of preparing themselves for spiritual training. Because if we fix our thoughts on something very familiar for a certain period of time, we can be certain that we are thinking objectively. If we ask, what is a pencil made of? How are these materials prepared? How are they put together to make pencils? When were pencils invented, and so on, our thoughts correspond to reality much more closely than they do if we think about the origin of human beings or the nature of life. Simple thought exercises are better for developing objective thinking about the Saturn, Sun, and Moon phases of evolution than any complicated scholarly ideas, because what we think about is not the point, at least initially. The point is to think objectively, using our own inner strength. Once we have taught ourselves objectivity by practicing on sense-perceptible physical processes that are easily surveyed, our thinking becomes accustomed to striving for objectivity, even when it does not feel constrained by the physical world of the senses and its laws. We break ourselves of the habit of allowing our thoughts to wander without regard for the facts. The soul must become a ruler in the domain of the will, just as it is in the world of thoughts. Here again life itself appears as the controlling element in the physical world of the senses. It makes us need certain things, and our will feels roused to satisfy these needs. For the sake of higher training, we must get used to strictly obeying our own commands. If we do this, we will become less and less inclined to desire non-essentials. Dissatisfaction and instability in our life of will, however, are based on desiring things without having any clear concept of realizing these desires. This dissatisfaction can disrupt our entire mental life when a higher I is trying to emerge from the soul. A good exercise is to tell ourselves to do something daily at a specific time over a number of months. Today, at this particular time, I will do this. We then gradually become able to determine what to do and when to do it in a way that makes it possible to carry out the action in question with great precision. In this way, we rise above damaging thoughts such as, quote, "I'd like this, but I want to do that," quote, unquote, with which disregard totally the feasibility of what we want. A very great man put these words into the mouth of a seer, quote, "I love whomever longs for the impossible," unquote, footnote, Goethe Faust, Part 2, Act 2, end footnote. This great man himself said, quote, "Living in ideas means treating the impossible as if it were possible," unquote, footnote, Goethe, Verses in Prose, end footnote. These statements, however, should not be used as objections to what has been presented here, because what Goethe and his seeress Manto ask can only be accomplished by those who have trained themselves in desiring what is possible, in order to then be able to apply their strong will to, quote, impossibilities, unquote, in a way that transforms them into possibilities. For the sake of spiritual training, the soul should also acquire a certain degree of composure with regard to the domain of feeling. For this to happen, the soul must master its expressions of joy and sorrow, pleasure and pain. There are many prejudices that become evident with regard to acquiring this particular quality. We might imagine that we would become dull and unreceptive to the world around us if we are not meant to empathize with rejoicing or pain. However, this is not the point. The soul should indeed rejoice when there is reason to rejoice, and it should feel pain when something sad happens. It is only meant to master its expressions of joy and sorrow, of pleasure and displeasure. With this as our goal, we will soon notice that rather than becoming dulled to pleasurable and painful events in our surroundings, the opposite is true. We are becoming more receptive to these things than we were previously. Admittedly, acquiring this character trait requires strict self-observation over a long period of time. We must make sure that we are able to empathize fully with joy and sorrow without losing ourselves and expressing our feelings involuntarily. What we are meant to suppress is not our justified pain, but involuntary weeping, not our abhorrence of a misdeed, but blind rage, not alertness to danger, but fruitless fear, and so on. Exercises like this are the only way for students of the spirit to acquire the mental tranquility that is needed to prevent the soul from leading a second unhealthy life, like a shadowy double, alongside the higher I, when this I is born, and especially when it begins to be active. Especially with regard to these things, it is important not to succumb to self-deception. It can easily seem to people that they already possess a certain equilibrium in ordinary life, and that they therefore do not need this exercise, but in fact it is doubly necessary for people like this. It's quite possible to be calm and composed in confronting things in ordinary life, and yet have our suppressed lack of equilibrium assert itself all the more when we ascend into a higher world. It is essential to realize that for purposes of spiritual training, what we seem to possess already is much less important than systematically practicing what we need to acquire. This sentence is quite correct, regardless of how contradictory it may seem. No matter what life may have taught us, what we teach ourselves is what serves the purposes of spiritual training. If life has taught us excitability, we need to break that habit. But if it has taught us complacency, we need to shake ourselves up through self-education, so that our soul's reactions correspond to the impressions they receive. People who cannot laugh at anything have as little control over their lives as people who are constantly provoked to uncontrollable laughter. An additional way of training our thinking and feeling is by acquiring a quality we can call positivity. There is a beautiful legend that tells of Christ Jesus and several other people walking past a dead dog. Footnote: a story attributed to the Persian poet Nizami, 1141 to 1203, and adapted by Goethe for inclusion in his Westöstlicher Divan. It is translated into English as Agrophon in Selected Poems, Angelos Sikelanios, Princeton University Press, Princeton, 1979, pages 137 to 139. End footnote. The others all turned away from the ugly sight, but Christ Jesus spoke admiringly of the animal's beautiful teeth. We can practice maintaining the soul attitude toward the world that this legend exemplifies. The erroneous, the bad, and the ugly must not prevent the soul from finding the true, the good, and the beautiful wherever they are present. We must not confuse this positivity with being artificially uncritical or arbitrarily closing our eyes to things that are bad, false, or inferior. It is possible to admire a dead animal's beautiful teeth and still see the decaying corpse. The corpse does not prevent us from seeing the beautiful teeth. We cannot consider bad things good and false things true, but we can reach the point where the bad does not prevent us from seeing the good, and errors do not keep us from seeing the truth. Our thinking undergoes a certain maturing process in connection with the will when we attempt never to allow anything we have experienced to deprive us of our unbiased receptivity to new experiences. For students of the Spirit, the thought, quote, "I've never heard of that, I don't believe it," unquote, should totally lose its meaning. During specific periods of time, we should be intent on using every opportunity to learn something new concerning everything and every being. If we are ready and willing to take previously unaccustomed points of view, we can learn from every current of air, every leaf, every babbling baby. Admittedly, it is easy to go too far with regard to this ability. At any given stage in life, we should not disregard all our previous experiences. We should indeed judge what we are experiencing in the present on the basis of past experiences. This belongs on one side of the scales. On the other, however, students of the Spirit must place their inclination to constantly experience new things, and especially their faith in the possibility that new experiences will contradict old ones. We have now listed 5 soul qualities that students in a genuine spiritual training need to acquire. Control of one's train of thought. Control of one's will impulses. Composure in the face of joy and sorrow. Positivity in judging the world. And receptivity in one's attitude toward life. Having spent certain periods of time practicing these qualities consecutively, we will then need to bring them into harmony with each other in our souls. We will need to practice them in pairs, or in combinations of 3 and 1 at the same time, and so on, in order to bring about this harmony. methods of spiritual training recommend these exercises, because if conscientiously carried out, they not only have the above-mentioned direct effects on students, but also affect them in many indirect ways that they need on their path to the spiritual worlds. If we do these exercises enough, we will encounter many shortcomings and errors in our soul life, and will discover the necessary means of strengthening and safeguarding the activity of our intellect, our feelings, and our character. Depending on our abilities, temperament, and character, we will certainly need many other exercises, but these will follow quite naturally from ample practice of the ones described above. In fact, we will notice that these exercises indirectly and gradually supply things that did not initially seem inherent in them. For example, after a certain time, people with too little self-confidence will notice that doing these exercises develops the self-confidence they need. The same is true of other soul qualities. (Specific and more detailed exercises can be found in my book, How to Know Higher Worlds.) It is significant that students of the Spirit are able to advance to ever higher levels of the faculties indicated. They must develop their control of thoughts and feelings to the point where their souls have the power to establish times of complete inner tranquility. During these times, students must keep their hearts and minds free of everything outer daily life brings with it in the way of joy and sorrow, satisfactions and concerns, and even tasks and demands. The only things that are allowed to enter the soul in this state of meditation are what the soul itself chooses to admit. It is easy for a certain prejudice to become apparent with regard to this. People might think that we would estrange ourselves from daily life and its tasks if we withdrew our heart and mind from them for certain periods during the day. In reality, however, this is not the case at all. If we give ourselves up to periods of inner stillness and peace, this engenders many powerful forces that are applicable even to our duties in daily life. As a result, we will not only not be worse at fulfilling our daily obligations, but will certainly be better at it than we were before. It is extremely valuable when people are able to detach themselves completely during these periods from thoughts about their personal concerns and rise to concerns that are shared by all. If they are able to fill their souls with communications from the higher spiritual worlds, and if this information is able to capture their interest to the same extent as their personal cares or concerns, this will prove especially fruitful for their souls. If we make an effort to intercede in our soul life and regulate it in this way, we will also find it possible to observe ourselves and our own concerns with the same composure we apply to the concerns of others. Being able to look at our own experiences, joys, and sorrows as if they belong to someone else is a good preparation for spiritual training. We can gradually acquire this ability to the necessary extent by taking time after our day's work is done to allow our experiences of the day to pass in front of us in the Spirit. We should see ourselves in the images of these experiences. That is, we must look in on ourselves in our daily lives as if from outside. We acquire a certain facility in self-observation of this sort by beginning with visualizations of small, isolated portions of our daily life. With practice, we become increasingly skillful in doing this retrospective view, so that after considerable practice, we are able to form a complete picture in a short time. Looking at our experiences in reverse order is especially valuable for spiritual training because it forces us to free our visualizations from our normal habit of merely tracing the course of sense-perceptible events with our thinking. In this reversed thinking, we visualize things correctly but are not bound by their sense-perceptible sequence. This is something we need in order to find our way into the spiritual world. It makes our visualizing stronger in a healthy way. That's why it is also good, in addition to visualizing our daily life in reverse, to do the same with other things, such as the sequence of a drama, a narrative, a melody, and so on. For students of the spirit, the ideal increasingly becomes to relate to the events they encounter in life with inner certainty and tranquility of soul, and to judge them according to their own inherent significance and value, rather than on the basis of a personal state of mind. With this ideal in view, students are able to create a foundation in their own souls for devoting effort to the above-mentioned meditation exercises on symbolic ideas or other thoughts and feelings. The prerequisites described here must be met, because we build up our supersensible experience on the basis of our standing in ordinary soul life before entering the spiritual world. In two different ways, everything we experience supersensibly is dependent on the soul's point of departure for entering this world. If we are not concerned from the very beginning with making a healthy faculty of judgment the basis of our spiritual training, we will develop supersensible faculties that perceive the spiritual world inexactly and incorrectly. Our spiritual organs of perception will not develop properly, so to speak. Just as we cannot see properly in the world of the senses if our eyes are defective or diseased, we also cannot perceive properly with spiritual organs that have not been developed on the basis of a healthy faculty of judgment. And if we take an immoral attitude as our point of departure, the way we ascend into the spiritual worlds will make our spiritual view seem clouded or dazed. We will confront supersensible worlds like someone observing the sensory world in a daze. Although in the sensory world such a person will surely not be capable of saying anything significant about that world, even dazed spiritual observers are more awake than people in a normal state of consciousness, so their statements become errors with regard to the spiritual world. Inner soundness of the imaginative stage of cognition is achieved when the habit of what we might call, quote, sense-free thinking, unquote, supports the soul meditations described here. If we form a thought on the basis of observing something in the physical world of the senses, this thought is not sense-free. However, such thoughts are not the only ones human beings are capable of having. Our thinking does not necessarily have to become empty and without content simply because we do not allow it to be filled with sensory observations. The safest and most obvious way for students of the spirit to learn sense-free thinking is by studying the facts that spiritual science communicate about the higher world, and by taking possession of them with their own thinking. Although these facts cannot be observed by our physical senses, we will find that we are able to comprehend them if we have enough patience and persistence. We cannot do research in the higher world or make observations of our own without higher training. But even without it, we can understand everything researchers communicate about this world. There is no reason for anyone to say, "How am I supposed to accept on faith what spiritual researchers say, since I can't see it for myself?" Simply by thinking about it, we can come to the conviction that this information is true. If we can't do this, it's not because it is impossible to believe in something we do not see, but simply because we have applied our thinking. Simply because how we have applied our thinking has not yet been sufficiently unbiased, comprehensive, and thorough. To come to clarity on this point, we must realize that human thinking, if it gets a strong inner grip on itself, can comprehend much more than we usually imagine it can. There is an inner entity inherent in thought itself that already has connections to the supersensible world. The soul is usually not aware of these connections, because it is in the habit of developing its thinking abilities only by applying them to the sensory world. As a result, the soul finds information about the supersensible world incomprehensible. However, this information actually is understandable not only to a spiritually trained way of thinking, but to any thinking that is aware of its full power and is willing to make use of it. By constantly making the statements of spiritual research our own, we become accustomed to thinking in a way that does not draw on sensory observations. We learn to recognize how thoughts interweave within the soul, how one thought seeks out another, even when the connections between them are not brought about by the power of sensory observation. Here, the essential thing is that we become aware of the inner life of the thought world. We become aware that if we are truly thinking, we are already in the domain of a living, supersensible world. We realize that something within us is building up a thought organism, and that we ourselves are one with this something. When we give ourselves up to sense-free thinking, we experience that something being-like is flowing into our inner life, just as the characteristics of sense-perceptible things flow into us through our physical organs when we observe by means of our senses. Observers of the sense-perceptible world say to themselves, "There is a rose in the space out there, and it is not strange to me, because it makes itself known through its color and its smell." When sense-free thinking is at work in us, we only need to be sufficiently unbiased to have the corresponding thought. Something being-like that links one thought to another within me, forming a thought organism, is making itself known to me. However, there is a difference between the sensations we have of things we observe in the outer sensory world and our sensations of the inherent reality that makes itself known in sense-free thinking. People observing a rose feel that they are observing it from outside, while people devoting themselves to sense-free thinking feel that the inherent reality that is making itself known to them is present within them. They feel one with it. Of course, those who can only bring themselves, either consciously or subconsciously, to acknowledge the existence of things that confront them in the way that external objects do, will not be able to have the feeling that something being-like in character can make itself known through the fact that they feel one with it. In order to see correctly in this connection, we must be able to have this inner experience. We must learn to distinguish the connections between thoughts that we create freely and arbitrarily from the ones we experience within ourselves when we silence our personal arbitrary will. In the case of the latter, we may then acknowledge that while we ourselves are quite still and are not creating any connections between thoughts, we are giving ourselves up to what, quote-unquote, thinks in us. We are then as fully justified in saying that something being-like in character is working in us as we are in saying that the rose is working on us when we perceive a certain red color or a particular scent. This is not contradicted by the fact that the contents of these particular thoughts of ours have been communicated to us by spiritual researchers. Although these thoughts are already present when we give ourselves up to them, it would be impossible for us to think them without recreating them anew in our souls in each single instance. In any case, the important point here is that when spiritual researchers awaken thoughts in their listeners and readers, these people must first draw these thoughts up out of themselves. In contrast, researchers who describe sense-perceptible realities point to things that their listeners and readers can observe in the world of the senses. Parenthesis. It's a long one, too. The path that leads us to sense-free thinking by means of information conveyed by spiritual science is absolutely reliable. However, there is another one that is even more reliable, and above all, more exact. It is presented in my books Goethe's Worldview and Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path. A footnote, Goethe's Worldview is Mercury Press, Spring Valley, New York, 1985. Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, A Philosophy of Freedom, Anthroposophic Press, Hudson, New York, 1995. End footnote. These books present the knowledge human thinking can gain when it does not devote itself to the impressions of the external physical world of the senses, but only to itself. What is then at work is not the thinking that indulges only in memories of sense-perceptible things. It is pure thinking, which acts like a living entity within the human being. Although these books include none of the information conveyed by spiritual science, they demonstrate that pure thinking, working only within itself, is capable of unlocking the secrets of the universe, life, and the human being. These works constitute an important intermediate level between knowing the world of the senses and knowing the spiritual world. They present what thinking can gain by rising above sensory observation while not yet becoming involved in spiritual research. If we allow these books to work on our entire souls, we are already in the spiritual world, but it makes itself known to us as the world of thoughts. People who feel that they are in a position to allow an intermediate stage such as this to work on them are traveling a safe path. It will give them a feeling for the higher world that will bear the most beautiful fruit in all times to come. End parentheses. That's the end of paragraph 33 on page 325. And I'll end this section here.